Did I hear any?
No.
No? As always, we welcome public comments and communications, and if there are any members of the public who appear and want to discuss something, that's not on the agenda, they can do so now. If it's on the agenda items coming up this afternoon, they can wait and do it then. If you want to make a statement, tell us who you are, and the floor is yours.
Good afternoon. My name is David Weissman, and that's spelled W-E-I-S-M-A-N. That's with one S, as opposed to, say, my cousin Arthur Weissman, who's the president and chief scientist for Green Seal of America, the environmental certification organization. Now, he spells it with two S's because apparently his father and my grandfather walked through different windows at Ellis Island sometime in the earlier part of the last century. And that got me thinking about names and that sort of lineage, and I began to wonder about the public comment period so far. It may be apparent that there hasn't been a lot of public comment. As I understand, there has been very little public comment. And I was wondering if there were some other names that are often familiar names that we have not heard from. Liz Appleberg, no, ring the bell. Jill Zamek, Bobby Scott, former people who were Linda Seeley, Lori Wolf, Richard Kransdorf, Ira Wynn. These are folks who normally make appearances at these things, and I began to speculate on why that might not be. And then it occurred to me, as I received a phone call from my parents last afternoon, that today is Yom Kippur, the holiest day of the Jewish calendar. And one can see why, in reference to those names that I have just read off, that might be a reason why the public showing here today is slimmer than normal, given the origins of those folks who I've just mentioned. Myself, an exception, and I would say that without being hypocritical, the folks in this community are well aware that I have not involved in that of my upbringing or childhood faith, but have moved on to certain Eastern philosophical practices, hence my appearance here today. But I do think that is something that could be or should be taken into account for future scheduling. Because in a community where there are these number of people who frequently do participate in these events, to schedule an event such as this on a day like Yom Kippur is kind of the equivalent of a Good Friday or an Easter Sunday in terms of the calendar. And I don't know, you know, hopefully that was merely an oversight and a lack of communication between the schedulers and not an indication of any form of cultural insensitivity, because when one really thinks about why we're all gathered here today, and I reflected on the names in Ellis Island, it made me think of some other names we can throw out. Leo Szilard and Otto Frisch and Albert Einstein and J. Robert Oppenheimer and, well, Niels Bohr and Richard Feynman and Hans Bethe and Lise Meitner and James Franck and Mrs. Fermi, we point out. Men who and women whose contributions are why, in fact, the very reason we're having a meeting like this at all today, and people of whom the faith was an important element, people for whom much in their later lives, as we've come to know, to varying degrees of regret and opposition, experienced a grave ethical and moral concern over what their intelligence and inventiveness and inquisitiveness had brought forth into the world. Some of them ranged from apathetic response, and others became quite opposed to both controlling this massive force, and in some cases, some of those named even calling for its abolition. And so since indeed it is you who have decided to convene this proceeding on what is the holiest day of atonement for those who follow the Mosaic laws, perhaps we could have some reflection on the thoughts of those who have just been named, names, well, not visible here, but present, I would hope, nonetheless. Thank you.
Well, David, I admit to realizing that this was Yom Kippur about 6 months after we set the date for the meeting. And I thought about whether we should change it or not, since it's my holiday, too. My holy day, to be specific. I decided not to because by that time so many things were locked in place, and I figured I could take care of my own feelings on this on my own privately, and I decided to go ahead. And you can question that, but that's about the story. Some of those names you read off are people that I know a lot about.
I don't know if at the rate it would either be expressed as a rate or a percentage. The ongoing need or deterioration of the steam generator tubes, as measured either in the amount needing to be plugged or the degree of lost capacity, as if we could please see. This has been information that's seemingly very difficult to get. I've made inquiries of the NRC Region 4. There's a long and lengthy correspondence between myself and Mr. William Jones. And his answers are non-answers in that he says the NRC doesn't trend these things. They fix them as they see them need to be fixed, but if they need to fix 10 in 1 year, they fix 10 in 1 year. If they unplug two later, they unplug two later. But they, he admits in this email, do not actually trend or collate this data, which we would think is kind of unusual, because trending for such a thing you would think is something that anyone concerned with long-life maintenance and ongoing repair would be. Anyway, he seems incapable of providing that answer. Perhaps you might be better equipped to get that.
Let me comment on that. The Electric Power Research Institute has been deeply involved with this subject for 20 years. They trend everything they can think of. Individual plants trend everything. The number of tubes involved in decisions about this has been published. It's been in our meetings. People have made presentations on it with slide after slide after slide. So the information does exist, and it was readily available at the last meeting and the meeting before that and the meeting for that before that. I don't remember Mrs. Becker specifically asking for that, although it might be in the minutes, but it certainly was in the package that we had for either the last meeting or the previous meeting. I'm certain there was a detailed discussion of that in the proceedings that the company was involved with regard to the steam generators. The reason NRC probably doesn't trend these numbers is because EPRI does it. They also are very difficult to make any sense out of, since you've got so many different utilities with so many different steam generators at so many different ages, and just a set of numbers don't have much meaning. So I'm not at all surprised that you don't have a real nice graph to point to as a trend line.
Dr. Rawson, after each refueling outage, we have PG&E make a presentation on the steam, on inspection of steam generators, how many are plugged, and all that. So it's in the record of our public meeting.
It sure is.
But at the last end of cycle meeting, when I asked that question, I was referred by the PG&E staff to the NRC. So I just walked 4 feet over to William Jones, and I asked him, and he said to send an inquiry, and I did. And that was the answer I received.
I'm sorry about that, but that was something that didn't involve this committee, and we were not aware of it. The fact is, these numbers are easily available. And Berman, do we have in any of the appendices the annual report something on that? In this year, I'm sure there is. Last year.
Well, the details are going to be in a presentation that the Diablo County people made at a public meeting. That's where all the details of the I don't know if our fact finding reports have that much detail in them.
Do we have the detail on the number of steam generator tubes that have been plugged though?
Yes.
In those reports. Okay.
I think we do.
Okay, because it wasn't at the end of cycle meeting. It wasn't part of any of the PowerPoint presentations at the last end of cycle meeting.
I think the information.
The Diablo Canyon Independent Safety Committee public meeting, not the NRC public meeting.
Okay.
Not the NRC.
All right.
Our meeting. After each outage, we have PG&E make a presentation to us about what they found during the steam generator inspections that outage in detail. How many plugged? How many have been plugged previously? How many were plugged during that outage? And what percentage is. So that information is available.
All right, well, then I'll.
That you speak with Mr. Wardell for a minute after you've completed your discussion with us, and I think he can point you to ample references.
Okay, yeah, it would be simple. I wasn't even looking that far back. I was just looking 00, 01, 02, 03,
well,
and 04.
We might be able to handle that right now, but I'll be glad to talk with you later. I don't know if you have the time to access our records in the Cal Poly Library or not. But in our annual reports, we have a section of each report which is entitled Steam Generator Performance. And we discuss that, like Jim said, at most of our meetings, particularly after outages. And we do track the number of tubes. That data is in our reports. If it's convenient for you to get it that way,
on the website.
If not, it's on our website, or we can give you a CD with our reports, last couple of reports.
A CD would work. That goes back how many years, or is it each year has its own CD?
This is just the last report, but on our website, it's also included on our website.
Okay.
For the last year, and that would be a start, I think.
That'd be great. Yeah, it's really all I need is like tubes plugged in 02, tubes plugged in 03, tubes plugged in 04.
There are a lot more than that.
Well, I'm sure there's, well, that's sometimes the problem is there's so much information just looking for the simple number, how many were reopened or unplugged and how many were plugged.
And if I'll give you my business card after the meeting or and with my email.
Replacement was increased, but if for somehow since 0001 when the first issue came to light, it's plateaued, for example, the answer might be then where's the urgency in pushing through for the steam generator replacement? If it's sharply escalated, by all means, if it's dropped off, perhaps
I would suggest there are a lot of other parameters besides a correlation with number of tubes that go into this kind of a decision that you ought to look into before you reach a conclusion.
Okay, but just starting by having some data anyway.
It's better to start with
some data is better than idle speculation. Well, next year in Jerusalem. Thank you.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, before Mr. Weissman leaves, I just wanted to mention that obviously in some 15 years now that I recall, we've never had a scheduling gaffe to speak of this sort, and you know, just it's never occurred. Obviously, it was inadvertent, but I think now being sensitized, we'll when we schedule these, when we look at those and call up and schedule the meetings, it's very simple to make that check, and we'll do that.
But also, for the record, we did have a public meeting yesterday that the public had an opportunity to make comments yesterday.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
Thank you.
Okay.
Good afternoon, folks. Nancy Castle, AGP Video, resident of Morro Bay. I wasn't able to get up yesterday to welcome you to my hometown, but I hope you enjoyed yourselves a little bit you've been able to see and that you had a pleasant dinner last night. Speaking of websites, I wanted to let you know that we are expanding on the internet, and I had the audio from yesterday's meeting uploaded to the internet. It's at slowspan.org, slowspan.org. And after today's meeting, we'll upload the audio directly, and then we will be putting the audio and the video stream up as well over the next week. And so once we have it up there, I'll be contacting Rob's office, and they can do a link from their website to our website. So people going to your website would be able to see the complete meeting.
Great.
And also would offer that to PG&E if they're interested, and hope that this affords more people the opportunity to hear and see what the work is that you folks do and the issues that you hear about, which is what the outreach element and our intent is with this project. So I wanted to let you know about that. On another issue, just for a moment, yesterday's presentation or comments by Mr. Booker about the hurricane issues in the south of the United States and his comments about the difficulty of evacuation and everyone's recognition as we've looked at the data coming from the south. We need to spend some time collectively looking at evacuation plans and see if they're feasible. I am aware that at one point there was a plan for this particular bay that if there was a disaster, the community of Los Osos, both lanes were supposed to come this direction towards the north. However, the school buses are stored in Morro Bay and were supposed to go somehow, I guess, float over to Los Osos to move the children. I don't know if that's been changed in the current evacuation plan, but I think that we're all sensitized to a much greater degree about disasters and the needs during disasters that it's going to take more looking at, and I hope that that becomes a topic of your committee's endeavors, and if it is part of your charge to be sure the community as a whole is prepared.
Seeing that the community is prepared is a little beyond our scope, but certainly taking another look at your overall emergency plan, which we haven't done as a committee for quite a while, is within our purview. Mm-hmm. And we will look into how we go about doing that. We might do it first at a fact-finding meeting and then organize a report for the public meeting.
I'd appreciate that.
I think also that it would be good for us to look at whether there are lessons learned from the hurricane evacuations that would affect or change the way that one would perform evacuation here. Any time you've had an event like this and you get additional experience under real on-the-ground conditions, it makes sense to look and see whether there's any lessons. We did that with the tsunami, and we had Lloyd Clough come and basically discuss what had been learned there. And so I think that this is actually a very good suggestion for us to follow through on.
The governor of Texas has set up a task force to do that same thing.
Are you on it?
No, I don't think.
All right. Thank you, folks. Have a good meeting.
Thank you, Nancy. Unless there's somebody else behind the podium, Donna, it's time to turn this session over to you.
All right. Thank you. First presentation we have for this afternoon is to do an update.
Just out of curiosity, Mr. Wiseman is already gone, I know, but had you planned to talk about steam generator tube plugging at all?
Oh, no, okay. I did not.
Sometimes we do, sometimes we don't.
I get in trouble if I start talking about that. I really need to leave that to the subject matter experts. But we're always interested in how many tubes are going to get plugged in an outage.
Yeah.
With regards to the objectives to the outage, I think the committee members will recognize these as pretty much the same type of goals that we routinely measure in a refueling outage, objectives that we have for an outage, and they, of course, are always specific to the outage that we're looking at. So this first slide really breaks down the objectives in the terms of industrial, radiological, and nuclear safety. And just a couple of comments on each of those. In the industrial safety, 2R12 was the first outage that we accomplished this goal. And so we're going to do it again. That's always going to be our objective of zero disabling to zero recordable injuries we owe to our employees and the people who come to our plant to work to let them go home in that condition. The dose goals for the outage, it should say person rim on there. I apologize, the committee gave me that feedback last time and we didn't get it in our slide, so that's error number two. And those are the goals for the outage, and they will be aggressive goals. As always, the goals do not in any way imply scope reduction for work that we need to do to make sure the plant is safe and reliable to operate. These goals really relate to our objectives of reducing the source term of the unit through good plant chemistry and shutdown practices. It relates to good worker practices in the field, very good pre-planning, and elimination of rework. So it's really the quality of the work. I strongly feel that it's not a coincidence that the jobs that go very well in the field are also the ones that come in at the lowest dose.
But sometimes you have things to do.
And that's exactly right. And so I just really wanted to make sure that I was clear, because I have heard that concern from the committee in the past, and we agree with that completely. If we have work that we need to do, by all means, we're going to take the industrial dose to do that.
I appreciate hearing from you on that, Brad, because I think we realize how critical that issue can be. And so I appreciate your making a point of it now, and just repeat urging you to be on the watch for any chink in the armor on that.
Very good, and we will continue to keep that in our foresight. Nuclear safety. Once again, these goals are broken down kind of in several different categories. With regards to these goals, we have had some challenges in this area in previous outages before, and particularly in 1R12, we had a lot of safety schedule changes that we had to implement, and really we were disappointed in that because several of those were avoidable had we done a better job in our scope identification and planning. We had a significant improvement in that area in 2R12, and that we reduced the number of change evaluations. And what I'm really targeting here are the change evaluations that reduce our planned defense in depth. We think it's a healthy process that for any sort of schedule or emergent issue that comes up, if it in any way affects a nuclear safety, shutdown safety related component, we want to do that evaluation to verify that we are indeed proceeding along the safe path and maintaining our defense in depth for the outage. So the total number of evaluations I do not consider a significant indicator, but we are disappointed when we have reductions in our defense in depth below what our original plan was. And so that's something we keep a very close eye on. Once again, we will do the right thing for the plant if an emergent issue comes up where we need to fix something. But what we want to do is evaluate the safest way to implement that repair in the outage and hopefully avoid getting below our planned defense in depth. And if we do, then evaluate what contingencies we can put in place to minimize the risk we incur in that condition.
Brad, could you take just a second to identify what you go through to make a determination as to what degraded condition you may find yourself in?
Sure.
Or that you plan to be in?
Sure. As part of our outage safety planning process, we have an outage safety plan, which I'm talking about a little bit later. But before the outage, when we develop our schedule, we specifically go through the safety plan criteria for equipment availability and validate that our schedule logic ensures that we have the equipment availability that we expect to have for our plan. And that's also implemented in one of our administrative procedures through checklists that we do every shift to validate that we are aided into our plan at the optimal time for defense in depth, and that form will take us through both those evaluations.
Okay.
Did I answer your question?
You did. I just have one quick follow-up.
Sure.
In the event you reach a situation where emergent work occurs to the extent that it could change your color code,
mm-hmm.
who makes that determination?
On whether it changes the color code?
Yeah.
The actual color coding is programmed into our ORAM safety program. Basically, the color code is based right on the operability and availability of the equipment as it's programmed in the... So it's basically matches our procedural checklist requirements.
But it's computer-driven.
It's computer-driven, but it's programmed by the people who have put that information in the computer. So it is pre-established what the color of the window will be based on the configuration.
And do you, on some basis, quality check the accuracy of that program?
We do. We have to do an assessment of that in some cases because the program itself will be conservative with regards to operability, availability, and functionality of equipment. And what I mean by that is, in some cases, we will show that a component is affected such that it will be available but not technically operable,
okay.
But its full function is available. And that is a consideration on what type of contingencies we'll need in place, but it might show an orange window, and we'll see that actually as a case one time during this outage.
Yes.
Okay.
I raise it to the extent that it could probably be of interest to people who would probably in the future be observing the ongoing sessions here.
Yeah. So, and those are case by case, you know, because for a minor degraded condition that maintains functionality, will change it orange the same way a complete loss of function.
Mm-hmm.
And so we really have to be, we have to really assess the conditions we have at hand and what the required corrective actions would be to optimize our safety in each case.
Perhaps as you proceed, and I unfortunately, or fortunately, because I'm impatient, jumped a little bit ahead and I looked at your chart. When you get there, can you describe what's driving you into that window that's colored orange?
Yes, I will. Thanks. That was my intent.
Thank you.
Is it sort of like a signal flag?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Optimally, we always would like to avoid any orange or red windows in any of our planning, and also during our implementation too, for that matter, right? Yellow is expected because yellow means that we don't have all of the full complement of components for each of those safety functions. So that's how you perform maintenance on that equipment. But orange is a circumstance we like to avoid. Our goal is to avoid. Okay.
Thank you. I think it's important you define that. That's good. Thank you.
Sure. Just go on to the next slide, Kim. Human performance objectives. We've never had a refueling outage yet where we've achieved this one yet, where we have no clock resetting events. Hopefully, Kerry Harbor yesterday gave you a presentation on human performance and talked about some of the initiatives. He did not talk to you yesterday?
He wasn't here. He had a replacement.
Oh, okay.
But we did hear about
it. Chuck talked to you about human performance for what our current initiatives are and with regards to 1R13.
Mm-hmm. Not a lot of detail, but yes.
Okay. So briefly, I'll say that we do have a lot of improvements for our human performance planning for 1R13. It incorporates some specific human performance OE binders and really looking at what the key areas within each work group is for new things, different things, risk areas for that group, and trying to target human performance measures to mitigate any sort of risk that would be occurring there. And also at a leadership level, we're going to try something that's fairly common and appears to have some good results in the industry of the term they're using is human performance blitz, where we have a high number of management observations in the field targeted during next week, which is the week before the outage, and then the first week of the outage, to see if we can identify any trends that we need to take action on right away and not have those trends continue to bite us later in the outage when the precursors told us we could have prevented the event if we had taken quick action.
Yeah, with that blitz, what the industry has found is you really have an opportunity to help shape the behaviors that you're going to be using for the rest of the outage. So we're ramping up with our supplemental personnel, so people are coming into the outage now. And by starting this blitz that we call the week before, we're able to help coach and provide feedback to our supplemental personnel even before the outage begins. So it helps give them feedback on what are the behaviors we expect when it comes to human performance and safety and work performance. And that's
okay. The schedule, the 39 days, our Rev 1 schedule is 38 days. So once again, an achievable goal.
Brad, are y'all still giving incentives or rewards for meeting these goals like y'all used to?
There is an outage performance recognition plan that's under review right now, and I don't know the exact status of that approval, Donna.
You still have one?
Yes. Yes. Okay. And these goals will all align perfectly to that performance recognition plan.
Just out of curiosity, how did you select 30 continuous days of full power, or greater than or equal to 30? What's magic about 30?
Actually, nothing. Quite frankly, it was kind of an arbitrary goal that was chosen by our leadership to say, okay, whatever happened was probably not a direct outcome of the work we performed in the refueling outage. Now, quite frankly, if on day 31 of the outage we come down because we performed poor quality work during the outage, it's something we touched, and we decide after the fact that's what caused us to have to come down at day 31 or day 60 or whatever, well, then we will not feel that we've met that goal. It's just something discernible that we could put out. The real goal is breaker to breaker.
But normally, if you had some problems coming out of the outage, it would happen pretty quickly, really.
Right.
Typically, that's why the 30 days, is that typically you would see it shortly after you start up, typically. We can go ahead to the next slide. I'm going to talk very briefly about each of these scope items. The reactor vessel head inspection, this is an ongoing program that we're going to be in for the Industry Alloy 600 issue until we replace our reactor vessel heads. And so this will be a volumetric inspection of the vessel head, and then also a bare metal visual on the top head of the vessel. And And this will be the first volumetric inspection of the Unit 1 vessel head.
For the new vessel head, is it going to have a different insulation system that simplifies inspection, or will it be similar to the... I'm not
I'm
sure
sorry,
what
was the question?
For the new vessel head, will it have a different insulation system design that will simplify the inspection process? Or
we'll be looking at all that. We haven't gotten far enough into that project at all, so that'll be one of the considerations for that.
Okay.
Certainly, the industry issue that's driving the periodicity of these inspections, we'll be using different materials for a new vessel head that would not have that same alloy 600 cracking issue that, or the objective would be to eliminate that issue as a design feature.
One of the major objectives of the French switching over to other alloys years ago was to eliminate inspections. I don't think you're going to be able to eliminate inspections.
I'm fairly certain that's true.
But I would certainly hope that once it's established, whether it's through your own vessel head, more likely with other ones that are already in service, that they're performing well, that the demands for every outage or every other outage and so on for detailed inspection would go away. It's self-defeating if you don't get any benefit out of an improvement that you've made. So I would certainly hope the industry pursues that.
I think, though, that there are ways that you can design the insulation system for the upper head that greatly facilitate inspection. That's the other option you have, is with the new one to simplify the process so it's not such a burden to perform. And then it doesn't matter quite as much.
Yeah, but that phase of the inspection is not the whole story. There's a lot of other exposure involved.
Yeah. I'm certain the project team, as they get further along in the design specification, will be able to talk to you more about that.
So you haven't audited yet, I guess, is what I'm saying.
That's correct.
Okay. Another major scope item is the 10-year reactor vessel in service inspection. This is our code required inspection period. And so this is a big evolution for this, because obviously we only do it once every 10 years, and it does entail removal of the lower reactor internals. And so once again, we haven't done that since 1995. So it's a big evolution. It's radiologically significant, because in order to move those internals to the stand, the internals do come up out of the water. And so from a containment perspective, we do have to severely limit access to the containment structure while this is going on, and it's a good half-shift evolution to do this. It's a slow process. And so it's a significant evolution for us. The inspection itself is not unknown in the industry, and that's a contrapole to make sure that our activities are very well integrated and controlled so that we don't generate any safety issues with regards to the personnel doing the work and the equipment that we're doing the work on. In particular, in our main condenser, there's a lot of cutting and welding and confined space issues inside the condenser to perform this work that we want to have very carefully controlled.
You've already done this upgrade for Unit 2.
No, we have not.
Oh, you have not.
This is
what are those big low-pressure turbine rotors sitting out on the...
Okay, the ones that are not covered were our spare rotors that we've been swapping out. And this is really why we're doing this scope, is to address a maintenance issue. Basically, we have a blade cracking issue on those low-pressure turbines. We're going with a whole new style rotor to get us out of continuously refurbishing these LP rotors. Is very expensive, and of course reliability wise it's not optimal either, so we're going to better turbines.
And they're sitting out there on the pad now, is that what we saw?
What you'll see is when you drive out to the plant, you'll see the ones that are very nicely packaged and covered. Yeah. Those are the new ones.
Right. The other ones look pretty beaten up and worn out.
The other ones have been, basically, we have a rotor storage building where those are normally kept and environmentally controlled and other things. But in order to make room for the shells, the shells with the stationary components attached, we have those stored inside the rotor storage building. So we're protecting those from the environment while we put the old ones that we're going to discard outside.
Are you going to scrap them?
I don't know exactly the disposition of those as part of the project. Right now they're out in the parking lot. I don't know exactly when they're going to go down the road and exactly what type of salvage we'll get from those.
It's not the sort of thing that people are lining up to try to get a hold of, I imagine.
You know, I don't know. I really don't know where they would go. Reactor coolant pump 1-2 internals project. This is another project that we're taking on as part of an industry issue with shaft cracking on reactor coolant pumps of the make and model that we have. And it has to do with temperature, low temperature operation, counterclockwise flow rotation, and you know, so there's a few service hours that has quite a few different issues playing in here. This is significant for us because we've never done this evolution. We've never actually removed the pump internals part of a reactor coolant pump. And it's also significant for us in that we're very interested, once we've actually performed this evolution, get the internals out for this one in particular, to do the diagnostics on the condition of our pump internals, because it'll tell us what we need to do for our long-term plans in the future regarding other internals replacements.
The fact that you haven't done it, what's the level of industry experience here, and do you have experienced contractors who are going to be involved with it?
The answer to yes, reactor coolant pump internals have been replaced frequently in the industry. With regards to this is a contracted scope that we're contracting Westinghouse to do, a lot of experience with pump internals replacements at other plants. There is a lot of industry OE regarding implementation of this type of project, and most of it has to do with just difficulties in performing the work, stuck studs, because the studs get, you know, been in there a long time and haven't been loosened, those type of things. And then also a lot of concerns about the internals is going to be a highly radioactive component, and so we have to pull that out and transport it safely to its shipping container. So there's a lot of coordination going on with regards to the transport path and making sure we don't spread contamination in the process.
Who will do the diagnostic?
The diagnostic is going to be Westinghouse. We won't get the word back on this. It takes some time after we ship it to get it deconned so that they can actually do the work they need to do. So I believe January is before we'll know what this tells us.
I was just curious what Diablo Canyon's involvement might be with respect to the diagnostic work.
We'll have engineers back at the facility when that happens, and what they've done is they've already built up a chart. Basically, it's a decision tree of based on tentative results that we might receive and what actions we would take based on that. They've already reviewed the industry data for these similar type pumps, make and model, so that they've built that decision tree, that they will be there present during the inspections.
Sounds like you've got that well planned.
I'm always nervous when we do something new, but I'm an outage manager. That's my job,
I'm
right?
I'm not speaking of the job itself. I'm thinking of the diagnostic approach.
There you go.
The oversight you're providing with that. That's great. I think that's good.
I'm really interested in the answer because it will generate impacts on our outage planning for the future. But we'll do what we need to do.
Yeah.
If there's an issue that we need to address, we will fix it.
Yeah.
The next one I added to the list, we do these 10-year motor inspections, and we have been for several hours, and then also the cubicle hinge wiring replacement, and those are basically corrective action follow-ups for issues we've discovered internally in our own internal experience in the past. And so these will be an ongoing project. I included up here because if you look at what the critical path for our refueling outage, if you will, both primary side, secondary side, and because of this electrical work is all very close to being the driver for the refueling outage. So pretty big, complex outage, a lot of scope and a lot of corrective actions, a lot of equipment reliability issues being addressed this outage.
Are you configured to be able to test the breaker modifications, or will you have to wait until the end of the journey before you're able to do that?
No, we actually do post-modification testing at the time that we... really, it's just taking the hinge wire from the door of the breaker cubicle through the loom and back to its connections in the cubicle. And so we write special tests to test all of those before we call the bus operable and return it to service. Steam generator primary area current testing. I did know that you would ask about steam generator scopes, so I better put it on there. And really, this is close to a plain vanilla scope outage as we can get until we replace steam generators right now. We're doing the primary side 100% bobbin eddy current testing, the first 10 rows of the plus point in the U-bend region. And then on the secondary side, really no unusual scope, just sludge lancing. So very straightforward steam generator scope this outage.
Have you figured out how much sludge you think you may collect?
Well, we did chemical cleaning last outage, so we're hopeful that we'll get very little.
Small, huh?
So I haven't heard an estimate on a pounds basis, but we would expect that we've controlled our chemistry well this cycle and would not have gotten a lot of sludge.
Good test case for you.
We'll find out.
Yeah.
It'll be interesting. Last one, breaker 532. This is a 500 kV generator output breaker up in our 500 switchyard. It's significant because this project's already begun. We normally have redundant breakers closed in the 500 yard for normal output. That breaker's already cleared, so we're on single breaker. And so operationally, we consider that a little more risky situation from an inadvertent relay action or something causing a unit trip and giving us a reactor trip or a full load rejection. And as part of the outage, this certainly impacts our configuration of the work we can do in the switchyard, because we want to be very careful, particularly in the configuration where we've done the main bank work, we've replaced this breaker, and we will not have completed the testing of this breaker until we restart the unit, because the relaying is bidirectional relaying. So we can only test the relays in one direction when we're back feeding from the 500 yard to the unit. We have to wait till we're actually at power to do the bidirectional full completion of the post-modification testing. So we won't be actually completing the testing on this until we're at 48% power. So that's a long time from virtually a month before the outage till getting up to 48% power that we will only have single breaker on this.
Why was you starting on this particular job before the outage?
Why did we start on it before the outage?
Yeah.
It's certainly the scope did not fit within the outage window. This is a transmission and distribution project, and they've done this type of breaker replacement at many other units, in the PG&E system.
I'm not speaking of the breaker replacement. I'm talking about the generator just operating the one breaker. The other breaker.
Right.
So if you have a relay on that other breaker, then your unit's gone.
That's correct. That's correct. So it was a risk assessment on whether this was safe to do versus the circumstance where we would have had to.
Would it have impacted the outage?
Oh yeah, it would have extended the outage by almost
a month. Oh,
okay.
Almost a month.
Okay.
Almost a month impact on the outage.
And we also did on the other breaker that we're relying on now. We did some additional PMs and looks prior to clearing this breaker, just as an extra check before we cleared it. Mm-hmm.
Those are the major scope items that I thought were like new or different or big drivers for the outage that I thought I'd talk to the committee about. So the next topic is really getting into some of the outage safety plan items that I've traditionally talked to the committee about, and if there's any other aspects of the outage safety plan, feel free to ask. In frequently performed tasks or evolutions, we actually revised our administrative procedure to firm up the definition of these evolutions for Diablo Canyon. And as a result of that, it's really a more conservative position than what we've done in the past. So what you'll find is we have 6 defined and frequently performed tasks or evolutions for 1R13. And some of these are actually evolutions that we haven't activities with the 10-year vessel inspection and the reactor coolant pump internals work. We have a long core unload window. And all the steam generator work well fits into that window. There was no business case for doing the mid-loop before core unload. We are doing a mid-loop after core reload, and this is solely for the purpose of doing our vacuum refill activities for starting the plant up. The nozzle dam removal for supportive steam generator work will actually occur prior to loading the core. So you can read it for yourself. Basically, the estimated time to boil calculation is approximately an hour when we're in the mid-loop configuration at that time. And we will have all of our off-site and diesel generator electrical power supplies at the time.
When is the last time you were at mid-loop?
Last time at mid-loop? Well, we were at mid-loop in 2R12, so that was last fall, or a year ago, if you will. And once again, that was at the after the core load. So this is a very analogous type of situation.
That was a cold mid-loop as well, as we did a vacuum fill and vent of the RCS.
Right. Integrated safeguards testing. This is one of those activities I was describing before that we routinely do every outage. But we basically configure ourselves to give ourselves a safety injection system and watch all of our electrical buses and all the components cycle on and do their bus transfers. The reason we flag this as an infrequently performed test for evolution is, in the event of a failure, we could potentially lose an electrical bus, we could have our residual heat removal pump not load, or some sort of circumstance in which we could temporarily lose that forced core cooling. And so in response to that, we say, you know, we should have the additional oversight requirements and the additional industry operating experience and tailboard requirements that this infrequently performed test and evolution process mandates for that type of activity. We only do it once every refueling outage, right? Same way with the bottom one, the containment spray performance testing. That one's a little bit of a sleeper. People wouldn't think of that one. But the alignment we actually do to perform that testing is we need to flow those containment spray pumps to do performance tests with containment spray. And the way we do that is we realign it through our residual heat removal system to go to the refueling cavity. Well, in order to get a mass balance in our refueling cavity, we have to realign the opposite chain of residual heat removal to reject back to our refueling water storage tank. That configuration basically puts us a one-valve misalignment potential to be rejecting cavity level, basically one-valve alignment away from losing cooling inventory. Mm-hmm. So that's why we think that's one to keep an eye on. Industry experience has had a lot of misalignment problems with core cooling doing these type of evolutions, and so we think it's worthy of extra attention.
When you say one valve alignment, are you really saying that you're working behind one closed valve?
That's correct.
That's not something you'd normally like to do.
That's correct. It's the only we're required to do this performance testing, and
yeah,
it's the only configuration
I know.
We can physically do it.
I know.
So from a design of the plant basis, we certainly would like to have double isolation or a different configuration for testing.
How long do you think you'll be in that valve configuration?
Oh, the testing itself is a couple hours.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the actual alignment to do the testing takes twice that long, and then the subsequent realignment. For when we're actually running the test itself, it's a couple hours, and the whole evolution lasts about a shift.
Okay. Before we leave this page, can I back you up with one question on the nozzle dam issue?
Sure.
Do you plan on doing any steam generator work while you're at mid-loop?
No.
Thank you.
No, we expect to have the nozzle dams out, the manways on.
Good. Thank you.
These last three, once again, the first one, the drain below 25% pressurizer level, this is really a response to industry events with reactor vessel refueling water level indication. There have been so many industry events with inadequate vent paths and other things, and particularly when you first put your riverless system, your refueling reactor vessel level indication system in service. And we've had a couple of events at our own plant in our history with regards to this evolution. That once again, when we evaluate it against our criteria, we think we need special attention to when we're getting ready to do this work.
You're not having any pressurizer issues, general type pressurizer issues?
No, there's no real pressurizer scope this outage.
Okay.
The last two are just unusual configurations, and they really relate to that breaker fight procedure for control of activities while on single offsite power. We have a shiftly check on activities in the switch yards themselves. The ones that are more concerned to us are any sort of line testing, relay testing that could be happening at a different substation. That could be very stealthy to us, and so we really need good communications with our transmission folks to make sure that they're aware of our configuration and that they're not.
Will you be using your QV people to maybe doing some checks on what they're doing down there?
I'm not aware of that plan on ours. We can consider it.
Something they want to think about.
Okay. Yeah, I don't really know of that aspect. And there may be some other checks going on with either our engineering or quality people, but I'm not certain. Or our operations folks. Any other questions on infrequently performed task resolutions? This is the chart that we talked about before, and really the only thing I did want to call your attention to was that one orange window and what's driving that. What's driving that is for our outage safety plan and our minimum required defense in depth, we have three component cooling water pumps, and we intend for our defense in depth requirements to always have two of those available at any time. For this little window here, we are doing a couple of cell replacements on vital battery 1-2. Because of the power supply that battery 1-2 provides for CCW pump 1-2 start logic and other things, technically CCW pump 1-2 becomes operable while we're doing this inoperable while we're doing this battery cell replacement. So this is exactly one of those circumstances where we talked about before, where we have to actually consider the ramifications of what that orange window is telling us and do some evaluation of how bad is it. So the battery itself remains functional the whole time because we're doing individual cell replacements. There's two cells we're replacing, and we're actually hooking up a jumper to maintain the battery and the DC bus available during that whole time. So functionality, it's the battery still available. The CCW pump obviously is available the whole time. But from a operability perspective, when we say that the battery and the CCW, subsequently the CCW pump become inoperable, it turns that window orange on us. I think that's a good thing because it's a conservative way for ORAM to treat that, so we do have to look at the details and understand exactly why that is and do that assessment.
Go ahead.
That is specifically addressed in the outage safety plan, explaining that orange window, so when the PSRC reviewed that, they had understanding around that.
I'm just a little confused on what drove the window. When you started planning this particular evolution, you knew you were going to be in this situation.
That's correct.
I mean, you didn't stick numbers in and then the program popped up with an orange.
No, we were not surprised by this. We expected this configuration.
You'd have been surprised if the program didn't show it.
That's right. We'd have been surprised and wondering what was wrong with our model.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
How long a period of time, Brad, will you be in?
It's approximately a day.
One day.
Yeah. To do the cell replacement.
Where's the reactor in-service inspection fit into the schedule?
Reactor in-service inspection, well, if you want to look, what you see is you see that lineup of yellow windows there. That's when we pull the internals out of the reactor vessel in preparation for core load.
So can you reference a day for them to help see that?
Yeah. So basically when we complete core load, it's about the 2nd of November.
Okay.
And then we will kick off the activities to pull the internals and go. So
core offload is completed around the 2nd or the...
That's correct.
It's
completed the day before, and then we have all the preparation activities. The in-service inspection doesn't start immediately when we finish core offload.
Mm-hmm.
What we do at that point is we put the temporary reactor head. We have a flying saucer, we call it.
Mm-hmm.
We put it on top of the head. We drain down to allow us to put our steam generator nozzle dams in. With the core unloaded,
mm-hmm.
so we can allow our steam generator inspection work to proceed, and then mm-hmm. we go ahead and flood back up underneath the supplies and some other key factors. But by and large, a lot of it is driven by inventories. And what you'll notice is the absence of the big spike at the top of that peak on the front half. There would be a big spike there if we were doing a hot mid-loop, which, you know, typically would be the highest risk period of the refueling outage. Relative to other refueling outages, this is certainly no more risky, and it's actually, when you look at the average and the cumulatives, it's a little lower risk than what we were looking at both the R12 outages.
So where does the orange window appear here?
The orange window, actually it appears during the baseline period when the core is unloaded. The reason it's orange at that time is component cooling water provides cooling to the spent fuel pool.
Well, it's a long way around.
That's why we evaluated that it was okay to have the orange window.
Yeah.
It's a long time to boil in the spent fuel pool if you lost all those other functions, but we didn't really want to go there. We scheduled it the safest place we possibly could do it.
Your tools provide you with a lot of hints now. Basically, you know what to expect, but it sounds like these tools are beginning to show things up to you now and then that you didn't think about.
Well, you know, that's why you check them, right? We build a schedule, we run the information, we actually run the colored windows by component all outage long, just because there's always the potential that these tools can help us find something we didn't see, and so. So, yeah, they're good tools. We use them because it's very important that we stay on our plan for these activities.
I must ask you. You stated within the last 60 seconds that this particular outage would be of less risk than previous outages, and I'd like you to try to qualify that a little bit.
The use
of that word, I think, is appropriate in the business. On the other hand, it may not be appropriate to individuals who may be watching this. So it's important, I think, that you qualify that a little bit.
Yeah, thanks for doing that, because there is a qualifying. It's really only in reference to the risk to core boiling curve and the numbers that we accumulate there. So I'm talking about the values that you'll see on this chart and the relative profiles that you would have if you compared previous outages to this particular measure of risk.
So you could say that there's a 1 in a million chance that you at the worst points along there in terms of risk that you might boil the core. If you were to boil the core, that the consequences of doing that would be quite benign. In the sense of fuel damage or release of radioactive material, you have to do a lot more than that in order to cause damage sufficient to actually release anything.
Yeah, and what this doesn't really show is the other defense in depth that we use to make sure that the systems are there for backup. And so there's a lot of training that's done and ensuring that systems are available if needed for core cooling, those types of things. So, you know, this gives you that snapshot. And then based on that, we take additional actions to make sure that we have those things in place.
So I agree with your assessment that my statement there really did need to be qualified. As an outage manager, when I perceive risk, I perceive risk of what happens if things don't go according to plan, and what are our contingency plans, particularly when we're doing new, different, significant evolutions. And so that's an area where, if you ask me what I worry most about from a risk perspective, is what happens if some of these major projects go wrong. And, you know, I worry about it, you know, because that's part of my charter as a project manager, to worry about all aspects, including the business aspects. But I also worry about it, and that could have put us in a risk significant configuration that we didn't expect. And that's always when we get an emergent issue. That's part of when I talk with my OCC players, I always say on emergent issue decision making, we have to make sure we're taking care of safety first, take care of plant equipment next, and then we can optimize costs and schedule. But we've got to cover those priorities in that order, because, you know, in those emergent issues, there can be potential for us to get off our plan. Sure. And where we think we're all right, we're not, and we need to check that at all times.
No, and I appreciate you and Ms. Jacobs responding to that. I guess I have one last question. What do you think is the biggest issue facing you in order to make your schedule?
Biggest issue to make the schedule? Mm-hmm. The complexity of all the various projects that are in the outage. Like I said, we've really got three paths that are virtually within a day of each other to completion of the outage.
And project and large of a scope. Are there things that distinguish that scale of activity from things that you've done before?
The answer is yes. Do I know what that looks like? I don't think I have a good enough picture of that yet. That project team has been ongoing for a while. One of the benchmarking trips I intend to take next year is to go to a plant that is actually in the process of implementing a steam generator replacement. I have an opportunity fall of next year to go do that, and I intend to do that because I need to get a better sense of how the outage implementation organization is responsible for the other scope of the outage, which is small relative to that big steam generator replacement project, interfaces with that project, because mm-hmm. it is such a large undertaking that it won't be business as usual for us. It'll be completely different.
And what the project management group is doing for this, currently the team that we'll have doing the construction for our steam generator replacements is doing a replacement outage at Callaway plant. And we have one of our lead people at Callaway actually working in their outage control center as the liaison for the steam generator replacement. So he's getting experience now with what it takes to help manage that job so we can help Brad. And then also myself, Rod Kerb, our director of strategic projects, we're going to Callaway in about a week and a half to go look at how all those interfaces take place so that we can start setting that up so we're prepared when we do it. It's about 2.5 years from now. So there's definitely things we're doing now to help set the stage that we can have a good execution for that outage.
I was also struck when we did the public tour today with the very large population that's already on site. Right. It gave me some appreciation of the number of people that come through and the complexity, I imagine, and difficulty of coordinating the congestion that occurs. And so I'm curious, when you get to something like steam generator replacement, is it yet more congestion, people, to what extent? Well, I guess that's the reason that you're going to go and monitor elsewhere to see where the surprises might be.
Well, we're doing that, and in addition, we recognize it's going to be more of an impact than what we're seeing with the turbine retrofit project. We will actually have more people in for the steam generator replacement outage. So we're already looking at things such as parking. Parking will definitely be an issue, and we'll actually have to use some of the parking areas for some temporary facilities to support the steam generator outage. So that means we'll have less parking. So then what's the right busing and shuttle plan for people supporting that work? So there's a broad variety of considerations that we're looking at right now and how to phase those in for the two replacement outages.
And also then I imagine that you're the most likely route is that you'll bring those in through Avila Beach, and then that means you'll be shutting down your road system while you're transporting them pretty well.
We don't have the agreed-upon path right now. That would be one method. The other method that we think would be preferred is actually to bring them in through our own intake, but we still have to complete the agreement on what that travel path will look like.
Okay.
It's premature, but I have to ask, are you going to have to do anything to your containment in order to get those old ones out and the new ones in?
They just fit.
They do fit.
A little goose grease on them.
I saw a animation during our fact finding. They've done the full 3D time motion study, which is, I think, one of the most interesting new capabilities that's provided by the computer aided design. Is that you can essentially do 4-dimensional modeling. You can add the time component in as well. And with these new tools, the ability to do things like identify interferences in construction and in assembly activities is much better. If you thinking about how tough it was to actually design and build and run things back when paper was used, it's amazing that the plants got built. Given how much easier it is now in many respects to do these things.
Okay, Furman?
Oh, yeah, one question, Brad. ORAM Sentinel now is your risk generator calculator. understand you're headed toward another one called, I think, Safety Monitor. Do you know when that might replace ORM Sentinel?
I don't know the status of that. That would we'd have to talk to the folks who do that risk analysis.
Okay.
But you know, I don't know when the date of that is. I don't believe it's going to be before 2R13 for sure. Maybe 1R14. Haven't heard the latest update.
Phil, last 2R12, you had your counterpart, I guess, had a contingency plan, I think, that you'd used for the first time, maybe in 2R12, maybe it's 1R12, but same thing this time?
Yeah, that's been my task this week, is to make sure I got all those contingency plans indexed and cataloged and loaded on the outage management website. But yes, we have...
Brad, thanks very much.
Okay, thank you.
Excellent presentation.
Appreciate it.
And you're welcome to stay, but this might be an opportunity for you, too, if you need to head back for outage preps. You can go ahead and do that.
Okay, thank you.
Nothing in particular. So I told Kent I would go ahead and present from the podium just to be easier to make sure we're advancing the slides. And I'm sorry, did you have a question?
I want to make sure you didn't expect me to say anything you're talking about.
Thanks. So the next topic we have is management review meetings or management review committee. It's been something you may have heard in your fact finding, and what I'd like to do is just give you an overview of what that looks like. It's still in development, but we're going to talk about why we're doing it and give you an idea of what that means. So the purpose of having a management review meeting, we abbreviate them MRMs, we're really good at abbreviations around here, so management review meetings. And what we want to do with these is really, we've talked about alignment, so it's to improve alignment of what our goals and objectives are. So it's looking at what's important for the station all the way down to the division level, or if you want to call it the department level, like operations and maintenance, and being able to look at what the performance metrics are for those areas and be able to report out with those. And what we've seen in our benchmarking is that those stations who use that, really it helps to build a clear alignment between what's important for the station and what's important for each of the divisions to help support the overall station performance. Also, it's really good at helping communicate expectations and results. And part of the way we do that is by clearly identifying what are those performance metrics that are going to be meaningful for us and what are our goals and how are we doing at achieving those. So it's ensuring that we all have that same picture of what it is we want to accomplish. And it also has, we've seen that it's really built some accountability throughout the organization. You involve the managers with coming up with the right metrics to measure performance in their area. They own those, and they're the ones that take the accountability for making sure we're performing at the right level.
Donna, who attends these meetings?
So who attends these would be managers and above, and we would expect, too, that we'd be bringing supervisors into these periodically. It'd be a great learning opportunity for them.
Do you have them every month, every week, every quarter?
So, kind of an idea. Let's paint the picture of what they are.
Yeah.
They're monthly meetings, and at the monthly meetings, I'll kind of talk through the structure. It would be an overview of the station-type goals, somewhat what we covered last night, but there would be more than what we reviewed there. So it would be the overall station goals. We'd be talking about what we accomplished in the last month, so it's identifying those things that went well, because what we found in our industry, we don't tend to do that very well, and it's hard to build upon successes if you don't communicate them. So what are the accomplishments we had? And then we would go through and, by exception, report out those areas that aren't meeting our goals. So it starts out at a station level. We then would cover what we call a program level. So similar to what you heard Chuck talk about with our Performance Improvement Governance Board, where we go through our corrective action program, human performance, self-assessment, benchmarking, we cover those as a program. And then we get into each department level performance metrics. So what are the performance metrics that's specific to those groups? And then after that, we would cover one or two initiatives from our performance plan. So do an update of where do we stand with progress on it, where are the areas that need attention going forward. So that's what that looks like, or what will be covered in that meeting.
How is this different from what was the officers, directors, whatever meeting, and before that it was the process improvement culture, whatever meeting? How is this different?
What this does is really puts together the different metrics we're going to use to look at our performance. and we haven't aligned those well in those past meetings that you talked about. So if we looked at that, in the officer-director meeting, we're currently going through the performance plan initiative. So weekly we review one or two of those. But we haven't been involving the managers with that, so they haven't gone through some of that. In some of the other meetings, we'll go through a piece, like just the program piece. But what one of the advantages that I've seen at other plants when this has been done is by getting into the division level, the maintenance, the operations, the engineering metrics, there's a lot of learning that happens between the manager levels about what's being important or what's measured in somebody else's group and how they support that. Since we don't cover this with all of the groups at this time, there's not a clear understanding of what those are. And so what we've seen in the industry is this is a tool that they use to help get that common communication and alignment.
Have you started this series, and how far along are you?
So the schedule, I'll go ahead and cover that because we'll be ending up flying through the last few slides. So the schedule for this is right now we are doing benchmarking for it. Our plan is to use the January data as the first data, and our first MRM, monthly management review meeting, will take place in February. And so at this point what we're doing is we're giving a preview. I reviewed this with our management team, a couple of more plants, to go benchmark to see how they actually perform the meeting, because I think that's going to be a point that we really need to execute well.
You're not going to get everybody at any of these meetings. Are you looking for maybe half of the eligible people to show up at one of these, or are you going to have two tiers of it? What's the plan?
Well, the plan would be that you'd always have to have somebody there from that group. So if the manager is not able to attend, they would need to see it, send somebody that could speak on behalf of that department. So there will be a required attendance for everybody from the manager level so that they can speak to their own metrics.
This is going to be a big room.
Yes.
It's hard to pull meaningful discussion out of a big group. And are you suggesting that other companies have found a way to do that?
So I don't. I think the question becomes how much dialogue and discussion. And from what I've seen is that typically what we'll do is go through the metric, and let's say there's a metric that we're not meeting or not performing well, and the response would be the manager steps up, this is mine, here is an outline of my recovery plan, the actions that I'm taking, and then here is the support needs that I have to make that happen, and this is what I expect my progress and result to be. And if there's more discussion outside of that, maybe there's a question or two back and forth to understand it, but other dialogue takes place outside the meeting. So that's what we're looking at now, is how much is covered in the meeting and what's done outside.
But the part you just described, is that rehearsed?
Pardon me?
Is that rehearsed? Is that all run through ahead of time so you know who's going to respond? He knows what he's going to respond to?
That's the expectation. So if you have a metric that's not meeting the goal, the manager knows that they have to come in prepared to address it.
I'm talking about rehearsed with the people that are in charge of this show.
Well, I'm not sure that we would rehearse that, but what we would do is have a clear expectation of how that flow would work. Because if it's rehearsed, then that in a sense would be the meeting that would have already been held. So I think it's just really clearly stating what's going to be covered. And I think, too, it's going to be some coaching the first few meetings so that we get used to what that standard is and what needs to be covered.
Well, I think that coaching should precede the first meeting, because you know, how that first meeting goes is going to influence how well the next one and the one after is going to go. And sure, you don't want a cut and dry performance, but you really don't want surprises. And you have to decide whether this is a diagnostic and a trying to work out an issue with a particular manager, or whether this is a demonstration or a production meant to illustrate something to the entire crowd that shows up. And those are two different things, and you really have to plan for them differently. If you want it to be an in-depth discussion with a particular department, then you better have three or four people there, not 40 or 50. So you got to figure out what you really want to do here.
I piggyback on what David has said to you. I think it's real important to decide what you want. and to structure it. So you, is this a forum for thinking collectively? Is this a forum for learning? Is this a forum for, you know, kind of show and tell on the checklist? Because this could quickly degenerate into show and tell. Everybody gets up with their, and they will be rehearsed. You better believe it, because they're going to give it to you. Are you going to be in there?
Of course.
Is Dave going to be in there? Is Jim going to be in there? They're going to be rehearsed, okay? A lot of time's going to go into the preparation. A lot of time's going to go into the practice. So do you want it to be show and tell and checklist? Did you meet the metric? Yes. Okay, you're off the hook. Did you meet the metric? No. Okay, what's your plan? Or is it truly a forum for people to think together and learn together? And David's right. They are different. And I think you need to be real careful, because a lot's going to go in behind this that you will never see, but it's going to take time away from other things. So be real clear what you guys want out of this before you put the forum together and manage the interaction in it.
And I agree, and that's why we're doing benchmarking at several stations for people that have been known to handle these well, to understand that. So it's, you know, observing the meeting, the preparation, and how much goes into the preparation. We are learning that in some places they have metrics that are more automated. Instead of somebody having to manually put together a spreadsheet every month, there's automated things. So there's a lot to learn here for us, and we'll definitely take that into consideration.
I just want to reiterate that's all very valuable, but you got to decide what you want out of this first,
right,
to know whether what you're benchmarking is relevant to what you want.
Right, and that's the stated purpose that we had. If we go back and we look at that, it's clearly identifying what are the performance metrics that are important to us, building that alignment around it, and what it takes to achieve those performance metrics. Really about that.
Does the NRC know about this?
Know about what?
About plants that are developing MRM programs.
I would think that the residents at those stations probably periodically attend them, so I'm not sure how they would feed that back through the agency, but I would think that there is an awareness of those.
Let me ask the same question about INFO and NEI. Are they on an industry-wide basis involved with these?
Not typically. Okay. They're really handled more, I would say, on a fleet basis. That's the fleets will set up how they want to cover and what metrics they want to look at. Which has really been pretty interesting, because as we've pulled different fleet samples of what different fleets use, you'll see some metrics that are the same, but you'll also see different metrics. And so that's what we're really looking at, is it helps you see what's important to the stations. Question came up on transformation, and we look at the corporation as a whole and what we're doing with transformation. It's transforming our corporation, so really looking at ourselves differently and being viewed differently by our customers and by our shareholders and by our employees. And so what the corporation has done is put together this vision document. And what you see is the vision, and in the bolded letters for the first three segments, that's the vision, kind of the mission and strategies for the corporation. So if we just talk through this, the vision for the corporation is to be the leading utility in the United States. And then what we've done with Diablo Canyon is to bring into that our piece and how we fit into that overall picture for the corporation. And so our vision is to establish Diablo as the best in the nuclear industry. And so really what we're doing is taking where the corporation is going and putting in the specifics for Diablo. How do we know if we've achieved our vision from the corporation? We'll know that, and you'll have to kind of listen to these words. We'll have delighted customers, energized employees, and rewarded shareholders. And we have ways to measure that. We have a J.D. Power survey that we use for our customers. We have a Premier survey, which goes to our employees and gets feedback. And then obviously for our shareholders, that's something that can be easily measured. For us internally at Diablo, we have our own metrics too, through the Nuclear Regulatory Commission and how we're viewed and evaluated there, as well as INPO. And that's how we'll know if we're achieving where we want to be. Strategies to get there. For the corporation, we're looking at how we perform operationally. So it's operational excellence. and then transformation. So these are the strategies we're implementing to help transform the corporation. There's a large transformation plan around this. Right now what we have with Diablo is our performance plan. These are the initiatives that we are taking to change ourselves to be able to achieve excellence within the nuclear industry. And then when we look at that bottom block, that's how we work. And really, these are the types of things that I think we all want to look for, right? We're talking about open and honest communications. We're talking about trust in the workplace, commitment to excellence, celebrating diversity, accountability for our own actions. These are the types of things we want to have for the corporation and for Diablo. So this shows how we fit together. Now, there's more to do with transformation, and we at the station are looking at that and how to best integrate with that. But this is just to give you an idea of where we stand in relation to where the company is headed.
Can you say anything about how the meeting that was run by corporate here a week or two ago went? I remember seeing an email about it, that there was going to be a big meeting. There are meetings throughout the system, and there was going to be one down here about corporate transformation and new management teams and so on.
So we've been holding transformation meetings throughout all of the areas for Pacific Gas and Electric. And we've had one at the station, and what we do is bring in some of our senior vice presidents from different areas to talk about it. And a lot of it is just opening up and answering questions from the employees, as is, what does it mean to me? What are we trying to accomplish? Feedback from the meeting is very positive. In fact, we monitor feedback from all of those meetings. And really, it's engaging the employees and helping to really communicate and understand what it's all about. And I think those have been received really well.
Okay.
Any other questions on that?
No.
No questions.
Okay. Would you compare or contrast this to what has been known as a TQM or Total Quality Management Initiative?
So comparing to a TQM, let me think about that.
Okay. Donna, thank you so much. For my part, I think this has been a very good 2 days. We've covered a lot, and I think we've been helped tremendously by the responses of the people who made the presentations and by your chairing of that table over there and working with us. So thank you very much. Committee, backfinding meetings for you two guys, the force on force drill. Have you got any final plan yet, or you want to work on it? We'll send an email sometime.
We'll work on it and send the email. We'll discuss after the meeting the final details.
And with Bill.
Yeah.
Okay. And in January, both Furman and Sheila will be with me on that fact-finding. Any other questions to resolve on schedule or administrative details at this point?
No, I think we're all set.
Okay, and we stand adjourned. Thank you all very much.
The April fact-finding.
Yeah.
What I'm going to do.
April?
I think that's what we talked about yesterday.